Hi there, global citizens. Welcome back to the podcast that inspires a borderless mindset around manifesting a new world. I'm your host, Florence Hadou, coming to you from an Independence Day Accra. And I feel, you know, it's kind of a bittersweet day here. And, you know, you'll be listening to this after Independence Day. I feel like we haven't quite broken the chains of colonization. And so in this conversation that we're having today with my guest, I hope that we get some insights to some extent on how to start to really move forward economically using examples and ways of building that she's been very versed in. And so let me get to her bio. She is Senior Executive Director of LISC, which is Local Initiative Support Corporation, New York, where she is responsible for leading the expansion strategy promoting LISC's statewide efforts to create an economic and community development ecosystem addressing deep-rooted systemic inequities. She has over 30 years of experience across private, public, and not-for-profit sectors. Before joining LISC New York in April 2020, she was Executive Vice President at Empire State Development Corporation, as well as Executive Director of the New York State Division of Minority and Women's Business Development. Previously, she was Vice President at the Brooklyn Navy Yard Development Corporation and Managing Director at Standard & Poor's Global Ratings. That's S&P for those who don't know. In addition to her extensive professional experience, she also serves as an advisory board member for the Fordham Urban Law Center and as a director on the Fordham Law Alumni Association. And in recent years, she has been expanding her portfolio to look at more global and diaspora experiences and capacity building. And she has also been working with groups such as United Cities and Local Developments of Africa, which is UCLG Africa. Valerie White, welcome to the podcast.
Well, thank you so much, Florence. And I you know, Facebook memory always gives us a lot of insight to how our life has been. And I happened to open it up today and see that it was the Ghanaian Independence Day. Mm-hmm. And that was my second trip after COVID to Accra. Mm. And I had the experience of getting my name, going to the return of the last bath, you know, the door of no return. Mm-hmm. I made sure I walked through because I returned. You know, it is a special day for us displaced Africans as well, mm-hmm. to celebrate the various Independence Day of all of the nations across the great continent. Mm-hmm. So happy Independence Day.
Thank you. And thank you for sharing that memory. It you know, it does mean something. And I don't mean to poo-poo at all, but, you know, there's work to be done. So
there's a lot of work to be done.
Yes. So let's get into it. Let's find out, where are you from? Where are you local? And what is your craft?
I actually was born in New York City. My parents met at Brooklyn College, so I'm a Brooklyn person now. But I grew up in Dutchess County, New York, in Fishkill, which is about 50 miles north of the Bronx. I went to college at Fordham University in the Bronx, ultimately ended up getting a master's degree from the New School and going back to Fordham for law. But when I graduated, those were the days that a young person can graduate from college and go straight to an apartment, which is not the case now. Right, with the shortage of available housing and affordable housing and just the, you know, overbearing cost. So I moved to Brooklyn in 1983 and I've been here ever since. And so I consider myself a Brooklynite.
Yes. And a neighbor. Inside Story folks, we're neighbors. Yeah. We're actually literally like neighbors.
I've had the opportunity to work in financial credit analytics and quantitative analytics in a variety of capacities, primarily looking at public finance transactions that go to the market for investment. So that includes things like affordable housing, home ownership opportunities for those who need specific help to get to home ownership, economic development, industrial development, global public finance, and then secondary security markets as well. So while I've worked in a variety of industries, whether it's government, nonprofit, and the private sector, I touched all three of the major ones, right? It's always been bringing either information, investment, growth, programmatic opportunities to those communities that are traditionally disinvested.
Okay. I love that. And so you mentioned out of college being able to get an apartment in Brooklyn. And so your first work, your first opportunity where you started your career was in affordable housing. So tell us about what drove you into that space and how you became kind of engaged and passionate about the work that you do.
It's interesting because I went to work right after graduate school to work for the city of New York. Initially, I was at the New York City Department of Personnel. And that's so long ago that doesn't even exist anymore. They call it something else. I don't know. But and in that work, I was doing quantitative analytics on performance measures. Mm-hmm. And then we had these consultants that would come in and provide training and all of that. And I'm telling this story because so many Black women have been influential in where I've aimed my career. And I want to be sure to give them their flowers. So I met this woman named Laura Blackburn. And Laura Blackburn was a consultant. She was the president of the NAACP at the time and a lawyer. And she was one of the trainees. And she ultimately ended up becoming the chair of the New York City Housing Authority. Mm-hmm. So when she went over there, she asked me if I wanted to come over. And the position that was open was the chief statistician. And in that role, it was collecting all the demographics about the residents of public housing in New York City, the need, the very long waiting list. We know, you know, historically, the most vulnerable people who need the most help with housing, which is a basic human, you know, need. Get the least amount of support, whether it's government appropriations, investments, or the like. So she was working to find ways to increase the amount in the portfolio. And part of being able to do that was to have the proper analytics on the demographics of not just who lived there, but what the population looked like. You know, at the time, there was a lot of doubling up, right? So what were the needs of those families and how can they be addressed rather than bringing in, you know, new tenants and seeing if that could be done. So that's kind of how it started, right? Understanding in a real way, right, that our vulnerable population does not have access to the basic needs that everyone else does. And when you don't have that type of access, it changes your trajectory in terms of wealth attainment and the social determinants of health and education and all of the things that just having basic food on the table, a safe place to live, and makes the ability for one to thrive. And so that's why we see such tremendous gaps in our society. So that really started my work. Both my parents were in supportive services, social services type work. And we were taught very young that we had to be in a position to use our education, our craft, to give back and ensure that we are fighting for equity for everybody that looks like us. And it was a, you know, interesting concept, but something that was ingrained in our family rubric.
Very interesting. So the data is the foundation of all of your work, which is so interesting because, you know, we talk a lot about, I think increasingly the analytics are becoming more of the conversation, right?
Right.
And so when you then moved on to spend most of your career as the most concentrated part of your career working in a ratings agency, tell us a little bit more about how you also kind of brought that social ethic to that work because you did some really interesting work there.
And, you know, it's interesting because initially when I was asked, I was recruited to go there because I was working on a specific, you know, project here in Brooklyn out on Rockaway Avenue on creating home ownership opportunities for residents of affordable housing. I'm sorry, public housing of NYCHA. And so this was a business that the rating agencies were starting to get into because there were new federal laws that allowed public housing authorities to securitize future appropriation for current debt so that they can sort of catch up with the maintenance that needed to be done. When I was being asked, I was like, well, I don't know if I'm a Wall Street lady. You know, I'm like, I don't have that Wall Street voice and the home voice, you know, I'm Black and I talk Black. I look Black. I'm going to act Black. And I had long braids. You probably remember Florence when you first met me. I had these long twists down to my derriere. And that was what I was carrying over to Wall Street in 1999. So it was interesting. When I met the person that was running the unit, it was a woman. She wasn't a Black woman, but she was a woman. And, you know, I said, I'll just go out and lunch. And I was like, listen, what I bring is this ingrained ethic into looking at these in analytics. And I need to know that you're going to be comfortable with that, because I'm quite certain that everybody else that work in the company won't be. So it was a mid-career change for me. And I don't know that I would have had the wherewithal to have had that conversation at 21 or 22, but at sure. you know, 35, you know, yeah. it's a different conversation.
Right.
And she said, absolutely, we need you to come because we're going to be expanding the opportunity for investment to all public housing across the U.S. And I knew how critically important that was because I spent so much time down in Washington and HUD and saw other housing authorities. So I decided to go ahead. And that was the basis of, you know, how I looked at the analytics, developing the methodologies to allow these analytics to be utilized when you look at affordable housing, government housing across the country. It is an investment. It's an investment, a social investment that we as folks in the country should be making to at least, you know, have enough supply for those who need it. So that kind of was the basis. And then in looking at the risk factors, understanding also you can't look at an affordable unit or a housing authority unit the same way you look at a commercial real estate housing unit, because they're going to turn over tenants, they're going to refinance in a different way, rather than try to stay with the units, make the properties, you know, habitable because it's a social purpose. So that was kind of also ingrained by adding a qualitative layer based on history and practice to the quantitative.
Interesting. So you bring up a really good point, because the customer for affordable housing, I mean, it's the local residents, but it's also whatever the governing authority is, right? So then you're really making a bet on a tax base that will then be able to support the ongoing injection of capital that manages and maintains this? Or is it more so about who's in leadership? Because then there's where the politics start to come in.
Exactly. Well, there's a little bit of a difference with housing, because even though it's a public finance, it's not what you customarily seen for like a general obligation transaction, which is the obligation of the entity that is issuing the bonds. In most cases, there's a wall off. So there's a special paper vehicle created. And so the analytics really are on the underwriting of that property. And that underwriting not only includes the rent that the individuals will pay, but it also includes government subsidies, whether it's grant subsidies, lower interest loans, support that historically you might have seen that a particular governing entity would provide a property or that type of property without putting their obligation on that particular property. So most times with housing is sort of segregated out. So it is a true structured finance transaction. Is just much more complex because the layer of the capital stack, the different type of money that one has to pull together to get one transaction done is like astounding. It's like a Jenga. And if one of those things don't pull, the entire deal falls. So it is hugely interesting. And I'm really, really fortunate that I had that opportunity to work in that space and kind of, you know, still do now as in a different form as the lender or one of, you know, many investors. I've written on this. I've published op-eds on it. We as a country here in the U.S. have to really think about the fact that the most complex transactions, the most costly transactions to provide this service, as I said earlier, of housing for the most vulnerable population, it speaks to how important we as a country think about housing those that are less fortunate.
Right. Like what we think about our basic human rights.
Who should have them and how the capital, right, plays into that.
Right. So interesting. So I want to take a little bit of a veer. And, you know, you've said you've been in Brooklyn for quite a long time, but I'm sure you've had opportunities to maybe be somewhere else along the course of the way. So this is where I like to ask why the where. So how did you come to be living, working, and playing where you are currently located?
I am a Brooklyn person. I've only considered a couple of other places. Maybe I spent a great deal of time. I think we talked about this, Florence, in London during the work, because once I had established the business for public housing across the U.S., I moved into creating methodologies to analyze social housing in Europe. And we had an office in London, and then spent time in Australia and had a whole staff in Mumbai, India, which was also very interesting, like just experiencing different cultures and the work, not ethic, but just the work cultures and environments that are in different places around the globe. So that was great. My home was always here. And, you know, I always still now I have the opportunity to work, you know, various places across the U.S. And then you mentioned I'm doing some work on my own separate from LISC in Africa. It's always here. And I think that it just gives me a grounding. Where we live, Florence, you know, is very culturally rich. It's got a very strong history. It's got a very strong Black history. We are seeing changes in the demographics of our most close neighbors, as well as the neighborhood. But there's still that essence of Afrocentricity right here in Brooklyn that I gravitate toward. Mm-hmm. And so, you know,
it just feels roots.
Feels roots. Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah. Okay. Sounds good. Now, you talked a little bit about, you know, doing these other works and working on methodologies and things like that. And I want to kind of put a lens on urban revitalization, because you did play fun fact, and I don't know if you knew this about me, but I did economic development for the city for quite a time, and I ran a program that worked with the Brooklyn Navy Yard. And so we were in talks, this is years and years ago.
Yeah, we crossed paths. Yeah. I don't think so.
No, not at all. Because my program was around the tech boom, and it was one of the tech districts. Okay. So I understand the Navy Yard very well, and the areas that were like untouchable and then the ones that could touch. And so we had one little place that they said, okay, we can try to attract tech tenants here and we'll do your little program here. And they did an okay job. But then the Navy Yard transformed into the film and the television, and then it's a whole new space.
Okay.
So you entered right about the time, I think, when Steiner had completed construction. And then this is when the master plan was now being implemented.
Yes, that's right. I worked on it.
Exactly. Yeah. So tell us about your experience with revitalizing and tell us about what the Brooklyn Navy Yard is and your work there in revitalizing that campus.
Well, I'll start for folks. The Brooklyn Navy Yard is one of five of the first naval bases that was set up by our second president, John Adams, to protect the new country. And so it was a key military space for many, many years, centuries, actually, right, that protected the U.S. Primarily from Britain, right, because that's who we were always fighting with, and, you know, a little bit France, maybe Spain, but primarily Britain. And so it is a historic landmark. It's been there since, you know, the beginning of the country. There was a point in time where it became a, you know, more of a manufacturing as opposed to a defense space. And indeed, during World War I, but in particular, World War II, that is where the bulk of all of the, you know, naval equipment was built. And even if you go walking in now in certain buildings, you know, and there's a building 77, it's now a little food hub and has businesses there. But if you walk in and you look up, you can see where the torpedoes, right, were slid down to go into the, you know, into the submarines, and so that the things can go out. So it's a really, really fascinating place. I lived, before I moved closer to where, you know, where we are now, I lived for 20 years on Waverly Avenue between Park and Myrtle. So I lived there. That was where my house was, as I had a house, I downsized. It was this thing that was there, you know, you knew history that, you know, that it employed, I think, during World War II, something like 1% of all the people in the nation. And if you think about that as a large, that is just huge. And it was a huge economic engine, but it had fallen into disrepair for a number of reasons. Number one, I think that the these ships were getting too big and they couldn't fit under the Verrazano Bridge. So the last ship had to be, put together in pieces. And then, there was an attempt to revitalize it by a couple of, congresspeople, including Shirley Chisholm, my sorority sister. So hi to my sorors out in the West African chapter. And, Delta Sigma Theta Sorority. Yes, they recently found it out there. And then there was a time where there was like corruption and all this stuff. So eventually it turned into a nonprofit. But what's important and why all that is important, surrounding the Navy Yard was built public housing, right? And so you had a whole community of folks who were moving there expecting to be able to have opportunities for workforce from this economic engine. And it just fell into this disrepair. And with it, that particular neighborhood saw unemployment rates just skyrocket and deterioration of this great facility. So the time that you were there probably was the very beginning of the start to redevelopment develop it as a contributor to economics in the neighborhood. When I started, the film studio was the first thing there, but there was a real effort to ensure that any economic progress that came to the yard incorporated the neighbors who have lived with this place for so many years. So there's so many different things there at the yard, including the employment center that works specifically with the people in public housing for training to ensure that they have opportunities to go and work in one of the 600 small manufacturing companies. Now it is an urban manufacturing space. The master plan included bringing a high quality supermarket to a place which was a food desert for people of color. And it's there now. The food hall that I mentioned that was in that old building 77, which now houses the headquarters of the Navy Yard, along with several other businesses, including a hip hop closet. My good friend, Kaish Kelly, who's actually from the neighborhood. The food in those places, they have to be a certain amount so that the people who work in the manufacturing can actually afford the lunch. And so when we decided who got the space, they had to have breakfast and lunch items at an affordable price so that the folks in the neighborhood could enjoy. So it was for me, it was a lesson of learning really what economic development was when you attach it to an entire ecosystem of housing, which I was familiar with, but also the ability to work, the ability to participate in a growth of an economy, and how all those things together, and entrepreneurship, frankly, how all those things together lead to breaking the cycle of poverty and giving more opportunity to attain wealth. So very interesting job and a very interesting time. Of course, now some of the things in the master plan are built. There's I saw the Fresh Direct wine store and the Wells Fargo and all that kind of thing down in here.
Yeah. Just to see from where it started, and that's one thing that I really appreciate about doing work in economic development, because when it goes right, you see it. And you see how communities change. And when it goes right for the people who it's meant for, then it's even more empowering, because that was very key, is that it was a tremendous food desert. And there was a tremendous barrier between the neighborhood. So that's the Fort Greene neighborhood in Brooklyn, Fort Greene, Clinton Hill, that it abuts. And on the other side, you already have this barrier, which you had Williamsburg, Brooklyn. And so you have a cultural divide and you have this big, huge, and now it's just like it's now kind of melding the communities together, which I think is a beautiful thing. The Domino Sugar Factory is now right across. And so you really
have the park. Yeah,
exactly. No,
the one thing out the Florence, if you ever go into Wegman, take a look and see who's working there into Wegmans, because you see a lot of young Black folks, and we specifically said to Wegmans, if you come there, you need to be hiring from there. So we created a whole training program, and they actually took the residents of public housing out to the Wegmans in New Jersey to shop, to be sure they had the cultural products there that were needed. We worked with New York City, City Tech College, which has a culinary institute. And so Wegmans actually has a class there in the Culinary Institute on pre-prepared meals. So they hire the students straight from there to go to that site to work as the chefs. And of course, you know, City Tech is one of the city university colleges that have the most immigrant population. Their income is much lower. So when, as you said, when it goes right, you can see it and it's important, but you have to be intentional, right, about making those connections.
Yeah, yeah. So I have a cute little story about Wegmans because I was in the shop one time and to your point, the employees are young. They're young kids from the neighborhood and they've been trained very well. And so I was picking up something, some kind of food, you know, healthy or whatever. And one of the staff people, she said, you know, I don't mean to bother you, but what do you use that for? Because I'm really trying to change my diet and this, that, the other. And I was like, wow, this is, you know, and I'm glad that she felt comfortable enough to ask. And so I gave her some tips and she was like, thank you so much. So yes. Yes, we can appreciate that work.
Yeah, but that's how it takes a village, right? So there's a village created in that ecosystem. And that I'm so glad she was comfortable enough to ask someone that she can see that looks like her, that's she can aspire to have a conversation about health. So great, good, great work for us.
Great work to you too. Okay. So speaking of just being connected to the local communities, let's talk about Glocal Speak. So we want to hear what you hear. So I ask you to share a word, a phrase, or a saying that is a meaningful part of your local experience and why or how you come to value it as Glocal Speak.
Oh, gosh. One is ride or die.
Okay. That's so Brooklyn. Ride or die.
Yeah, and that's Brooklyn, the ride or die. Because with that, you know who is going to be, you know, there to support you as an individual, your concepts, what you aspire to, your mission and how you want to contribute to the community. And so it sometimes, again, as I mentioned earlier, we're in an ever-changing community, right? We've seen quite a bit of changes right here in Clinton Avenue, namely right next door to our building, right? You know, that is not necessarily in alignment with the historical cultural place of where we live. So sometimes it gets difficult to have the type of conversations to say, yes, we believe in community development. Well, we don't believe in gentrification. Those are two different things. We want, yes, us here that live in the community want the fancy coffee and the extra nail place and to shop in the boutique and the restaurants. Yeah. But that doesn't mean that it has to be excluding those who've been in the neighborhood for so long. So gentrification is a very deliberate word. It's of the gentry, for the gentry. We are changing it so the gentry can have access to the things that they want. And that in and of itself, that word denotes the exclusion of people who may have already been there or not considered whatever the gentry is. So those conversations, you know, sometimes get difficult because I think that they get commingled on sort of both sides of the spectrum. So the ride or die folks, we're out there, you know, we want to be sure we're going to be advocating for services. We're going to be ensuring that people have equitable opportunity for growth and wealth. And it doesn't always fall on very pleasantly on the ears. So I like the ride or die. Whether it's in a personal thing, being around in Brooklyn or out in my doing the work that I do, if you're ride or die, girl, I got you, dude, I got you, let's go.
Yeah.
Right? And make changes that we need for our
people. Yeah, I love that. I love that. So speaking of now, let's talk about your current role, because this is where some real, not that you haven't been doing impactful work, you know, but LISC, because you started that work in a really challenging time and have been able to just move and still transform at a stellar pace. So tell us about LISC and tell us about what you're working on now.
So LISC is a local initiative support corporation. As you said, it was started about 24 years ago in the Bronx, and it is the concept of a community development, but involving the community in that development and ensuring that there is investment coming in to rebuild infrastructure, community infrastructure, which includes housing, the schools like the charter schools you work on, faith-based institutions, community, and then the economic engine, doing it in a way that it's meeting the needs of that specific community and that the community is enjoying the resources to sort of close the gap of access or the gap of wealth attainment that that particular community is experiencing. So I did start, it was literally right smack in the middle of the pandemic. I had been with the state of New York and I had given my notice on March 7th and had sat down and did the transition plan and walked out the office with on the 13th with my senior team. It's like, okay, you know, we're going to get this done, blah, blah, blah. And not knowing that I wasn't going to walk back in. So I actually ended up staying with the state for another month because I was running the Minority Women Business Enterprise Division. That's where there is a host of various vendors from across the state that are minority or women vendors that have supplies, among other things, contractors. So we had to very quickly mobilize and try to find a lot of supplies that were needed, like gowns and masks and all of the things that were not available. And on top of that, had to figure out how to CPE certify people online so that they could make the right material and we can get the nurses. They were wearing garbage bags. Remember, you know, they didn't have enough stuff. So I had to I didn't have to delay, but it was the right thing to do. And LISC agreed to just ensure that there was a standardized system to getting those supplies out throughout the state of New York. So when I started, it was interesting. I worked remote for two full years. I didn't get into the office for 2 years. I didn't meet my staff for a year and a half. So that was interesting. You get the usual time where you get to know them and, you know, the 90 days and all that kind of stuff that you do when you take over leadership of a new organization, because we did not have that time. We had to quickly stand up support. There were, at the time, there were, you know, different funds coming in from a variety of places that were trying to address the needs of the communities that were just, like, people didn't have food. Mm-hmm. They couldn't pay their rent. They couldn't get to where they were dying at these rapid rates. So and businesses were just going out of business because they weren't prepared, a lot of small businesses. So we stood up a couple of things very quickly. The LISC New York City Small Business Enterprise Program, we raised about $4 million, grants of $10,000 or more to small businesses, but we did it through providing capital and other resources to nonprofits across the city. We looked at 16 different ones and we determined the neighborhoods that had the most death, the most job loss, the most, illness, and knew that they had the most need. And those were the nonprofits that we worked with to identify the businesses and deploy that capital to them. But we wanted it to be sustainable. So there were a lot of folks that were, oh, we're giving $2,000 grants. Okay, thank you. Right? That's not going to be sustainable. I said no less than $10,000, but programming to help folks. So I'll name one place. I can't think of the name of this place, but I'm sure you know it. It's right over there by across the street from Bedvine, right? It's the wellness center, you know, the spa.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, you know, the sister, she's dynamic. And so she utilized the grant to upgrade her computer system so that she can expand her online marketing, right? There's another woman, another sister named Dawn Kelly. She runs a company called The Nourish Spot. She was able to, because delivery was big to, and it's fresh juices and the like. She was able to stay in business because she increased her delivery opportunities, the DoorDash. She now has a vending at the U.S. Open. She just opened her third location on Malcolm X Boulevard in Brooklyn. She was from Queens. I mentioned Kaish Kelly at the Navy Yard. She was making masks. In fact, we have LISC New York masks that we ordered from her. So a lot of folks were able to utilize that, not just the $10,000, but the support from the nonprofits. So that was one of the things that we had to do very quickly. But we just continued working with nonprofits, building their capacity. We are an intermediary investor. We also invest in real estate and disinvested communities, and that includes affordable housing, like I spoke about earlier. So we were doing that work across the city, trying to ensure that we're bringing those resources and capital. And then about 2 years ago, I was asked, we could look at this through New York State. You have a state relationship, different funding coming in from the federal government. Would you look at how do we expand this across the state? And so I said, okay, we had some staff in Buffalo. So I said, all right. And that was in May 2022, the beginning of May of 2022. And I took on that responsibility. Not 2 weeks later was the mass murder at Tops on Jefferson Avenue in Buffalo.
Right. Wow. Yeah.
So again, and I just came back from Buffalo. I spent a fair amount of time up there. We stood up very quickly because we had that experience, financial support to the neighborhood, because that was not just the supermarket. They had the blood pressure machines. People would get their blood pressure check there. People were cashing their checks there, getting their pharmaceuticals. So all of a sudden it stopped. And the public transportation in that neighborhood, it's isolated because two large interstates were built, decades ago, that now isolates the East Buffalo in an area that transportation is not great. So that is fascinating work. What I love about this is that I do spend a great deal of time in Albany with policy and legislative advocacy dealing with the border issues. But I get the opportunity to look at the issues that affect the market, very market specific, that are affecting the community, and tailor our investments and our programmatic support to that particular market to bring about the same alignment in, the change in the ecosystem. So through that, I'm meeting like a lot of interesting people in different sectors. We're starting now to work in Syracuse as well, which is another interesting area because that big Micron chip is coming, $100 billion with a B of economic impact over 20 years. So we need to be working to be sure that $100 billion economic impact is enjoyed by everybody. And that means preparing communities that may not have the opportunity to be part of that expansion. So yes, interesting. Yeah, interesting work.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think you have given us the grassroots of what the impacts of that kind of violence and those types of disruptions can really wreak havoc, because I didn't even know that it was, you heard on the news, it's just a supermarket. No, this was a community center. So to the extent that when we have senseless violence that is associated with, really continuing to marginalize people, then we really have these issues that we are having to contend with. So now thinking about your work, and I love that you are fully understanding and looking at all of the pieces, the moving pieces, where are you seeing the best partners emerging for your works and for community development now in the current environment?
Well, you do see investment from a variety of corporate places for a variety of reasons. And I'm going to say some statements, but they are kind of generalized because each corporation is different. So we'll start with the financial institutions that have to abide by the Community Reinvestment Act, which the new guidelines, the CRA. Basically, there's new guidelines that talk about investing in these communities in one way or another, where you, if a bank is taking deposits from individuals in the community, they need to be. And that started in the 80s. And through that act, the Community Development Financial Institution, CDFIs, which does have that designation and is the largest in the country, those financial institutions were set up to bring banking and other financial services to communities that didn't have them, because the banks, they took the deposit, but they may not have been given the loans, right? The business, so that was the reason why that was brought up. And now there's a little bit more meat on the requirements that just come out over the last year or so. So you get some of the funding from there, and some banks are really passionate about DE&I and community investment and equity. Others are doing what they need to do to meet the compliance requirements, right? So, and we are seeing a movement in corporate America away from DE&I programming in general. And you can relate that to equity, to wealth attainment, to all of those type of things, because even though they may say that they're doing different things, they are all related, right, to bringing us to this point of equity. Great partners in the community, not just the grassroots partners, and the grassroots are hugely important because that's the first line of service for to community members, whether it's a socioeconomic service, healthcare service, educational service, housing service. Those grassroots communities are doing the job very specific, you know, to the that neighborhood that brings the sort of social impact. So great partners there. Other large partners I just met with when I was in Buffalo, I worked with the head of the Urban League up there. I work with the head of the Urban League here in New York too. And the United Way of Greater Buffalo and Western New York, and just dynamic folks. The head of the Urban League down here, Arbor Rice in New York City, just very dynamic in addressing, you know, those key gap issues up in Buffalo's Thomas Buford, the Urban League there, the United Way is Trina Burris, and just folks who are looking to make the betterment of the community through these larger organizations. And then, you know, a variety of different elected officials that are dedicated to their community, not just here in New York City. I work closely with up in Mount Vernon with Mayor Sean Patterson Howard up there. She's also the head of the African American National Mayors Association, U.S. Mayors Association. And we've done some work on commercial quarters up there, LISC, some investing. A lot of commercial quarters, you've seen a change over the decades with the,
absolutely. Yeah, and more recently.
More recently.
Post-pandemic.
That's right.
Yeah.
And so we, you know, we do that work there, but it's been a different experience, obviously, on Tompkins Avenue with Bridge Street Development Corporation. So we actually connected the organization in Mount Vernon with the folks with Oma and Greg Anderson over there in Bridge Street. And so now they're working with each other to help build a similar opportunity in Mount Vernon. So we make those connectors across the state. So it is, and each area has, you know, different market issues, but the issues are still the same. So Syracuse, Rochester, we're doing some work there, and then the Capital Region Albany is our next target. So we're hopeful that we can build.
Sure. Yeah, because, you know, most people typically think New York and they think of New York City, but it's a whole state that has a number of urban centers that need attention.
Yeah, absolutely.
So you said something really interesting that I think kind of dovetails with your work, that sister organization, and then sister cities kind of work with some of the things you're doing abroad. But before we get to that, I want to ask you about a mindset hack. So we want to know what your favorite or an innovative mindset hack is. And this is one that you practice, one that you know of, or one that you can imagine.
Okay. So my favorite mindset hack is it's kind of a just keep going, right? if that makes sense. Because there, you know, there's always going to be these sort of roads and blocks and obstacles and, you know, moving forward in something. So I'm like, you know, we have to just keep going. If I have 10 things or 10 objectives, right? And 6 of them get to the next stage and I get 4 done, then I'm good, because you're never going to get the exact amount of things done. So you have to always have contingencies in the ethers, right? So I think that's, you know, if you keep going and you're true and authentic to the work that you want to do, then you're going to have the success. So that's what I always tell the staff. They're like, oh, so-and-so. I'm like, let's just keep going, right? Because this is right thing to do. Let's just keep going and we'll see. And most times, right, you end up being able to mitigate that challenge or move that roadblock out the way.
So. Yeah. And I like that you said that, especially, you know, bringing up your staff, because in all of your descriptions of the work that you do, you say that you work with experts. And so that means to me that you have a vision for excellence. And so I want to kind of understand a little bit more about your leadership style, you know, working with all these teams, because you've been able to become a strong leader, and then how that now is translating into your being able to be a leader on the international stage.
Yeah, well, I think when someone leads a team, you always have to very first recognize, right, that you're going to have three type of employees. You're going to have that, I guess, like I said before, that ride or die person. They're going to be on the train. Let's go. We're going to make these changes. We're going to do it. This is great, with a lot of ambition. Then you're going to have what I call the steady Eddies or steady Edwinas, you know, depending. Right? And they're the ones that are going to just do that steady. And they are extremely necessary because you need to have that foundational base. And so I don't think they should be overlooked or discounted as any less valuable because they serve a key purpose, right, to getting the team forward, because the other folks are, you know, doing all of this sort of, you know, ambitional work.
Yeah.
But then you still need the reports done, the compliance file, the data run, the model built, and all. And so that's the steady Eddies. Then you have the folks that just either they don't want to be on the train. If they don't have the skill set, that's a little bit different. That is, as a leader, you have to try to address that to identify what their challenges are, what their strengths are, and you find a way to utilize their strengths to develop, to mitigate the challenges, right? But if you just have people that just, they're obstructionist or they just don't want to do it or whatever, those are the people that you can invite not to ride anymore, right? You know, maybe you need to be riding on a different train, not mine, right? And so I think just sort of understanding that there's always going to be that three and being able to maneuver through that. But I do take my team leadership very seriously because there's the objective that one is trying to meet, right? The goal, the job that has to be done. And that's always going to be important because that's why we're on the team. That's why we're there at the organization. But I also feel like as a leader, we as leaders have a responsibility to develop the individual, not just technical development, but on how do you work as a professional. And so when the person either ascends and stays with you and does great, goes to another department in your organization or leaves altogether, they need to leave with that gained skill of negotiations, just being in an environment. How do you put your best foot forward? And, you know, I always tell managers who are underneath me, some people are going to remember you kindly. Some people are going to remember you not kindly. And some people may not remember you at all. But that doesn't denote or take away from your responsibility to develop that professional while they are on your team, and, you know, wish them well, regardless of how you part, still carry a well wish for them to continue to achieve in their future endeavors.
And I think you kind of mentioned a little bit of that culture concept when you were working outside of the U.S. And so tell us more about your work with in Africa and with the UCLG,
Africa. Well, I had the opportunity to go to the AfriCities conference in, that was 2022, in Kisumu, Kenya. So that was very exciting. I got to meet Lupita Nyong'o's dad because he's the governor of Kisumu. Actually, I've met him a couple of times. So, you know, call him the father of Wakanda, right? So he's very fascinating story, history of her and him and the family. And he's just a great individual. So I went to the conference and I was speaking on economic development for women in small businesses on a panel with folks from other places across the world. I got the opportunity to meet the secretary of the UCLG Africa and a number of folks who were working on a project to bring capital market investments to intermediary cities in Africa. And those are the smaller cities that are experiencing, you know, growth in population through urbanism because more people are moving from rural areas into the city. And so there is a strain on that infrastructure that we talked about here, you know, housing, healthcare, commercial real estate, and the like. So the UCLGA was looking to put together an agency, ATIA, African Trade Interagency, I think is the exact name of it. And what that thing would do is it would issue debt out to the capital markets in Africa and then loan to, you know, member cities, the money to build the infrastructure. And from having the opportunity to be around about, I think it's about 60 some odd cities that are currently members. They're trying to get to 100. I've done workshops and classes at a number of their conferences on the history of bond financing in the U.S. Came to be, and it was for urbanism, same exact concept for that they were doing here in New York City, actually, you know, general obligation bonds, which we talked about earlier. So just interesting to see that it's a similar need. We do know that Africa has the youngest population. I read that article in the Times, I think it was a couple of months ago. We do know that Africa is as a continent, is the least contributor to global climate destruction, but the feels the impact the most. Right. Mm-hmm. And of course, we know through colonization, just sort of the destruction of the natural resources that people take from a variety of countries there. So it was when I was asked, I jumped at the opportunity as a displaced African, as somebody who's can go back five generations from my father's grandmother's grandmother. That story carried with us, you know, again, told her granddaughter that she was from Dahomey. And she was kidnapped and brought over here and all of that. So, you know, we've been telling that story for, you know, many generations in my family. Here's a chance for me to go home. Right.
Yeah.
And so I did. And I've had the opportunity to go back, you know, several times and working with this group and some other work I'm doing with other developers that are developing other parts. So I'm just grateful. And every time I go, the first thing that I say to folks is I am so grateful to step on this land of my people. And it's a feeling that us as displaced Africans from here, I think it's a little bit different if, you know, someone is from the Caribbean because they have an attachment to that Caribbean island or whatever. We just don't have that kind of attachment. Right. And so when you go over there, it's like, I'm, you know, grateful to my ancestors to step my feet on this land. Thank you for having me, all of this type of thing. I just had a conversation with Malik Yoba, who, you know, the actor, he's over in Johannesburg right now. And he was posting something saying, oh, you know, the joy of coming to the land with the displaced African. And I was like, listen, it never gets old. Every single time I go, regardless of where it is, that emotion is still the same. And so I'm just really, really fortunate to have this opportunity and hope that, you know, what I've been able to learn in my career, that I can bring some contribution to the decolonization of wealth.
There we go.
Bringing it back to our people and wherever. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Decolonization is my phrase for everything.
Yes.
That is it. Because, you know, when I think about how to transfer a lot of these types of systems and the systems that you're familiar with and describing, I think about how and why this was never, and why it's so fraught when we're looking at it through the IMF and through the World Bank, because they are supposed to be that entity to work with the governments, do that. But we're not seeing any of that actually play out with actual physical long-term, I want to say, capacity building and investments that are really long-reaching. So,
right. Yeah.
This organization made this time for us to do it.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. And so I'm excited to see how this continues. The group put together an event here in New York City right ahead of the UN conference in September. And there was a room full of potential investors, stakeholders, and contributors from all over to really see this entity come to play. And again, but as, you know, run by Africans. And I think
exactly
a key point.
Yeah. Wonderful. So Valerie, before we sign off or move you into the rest of your morning, we want to know who Valerie is when she's not working and doing economic and development and being a business leader. Are you a reader? Are you a watcher? Are you a listener? Or what are some of your other interests that you take up in your free time?
Well, I'm an adventure seeker.
Okay. I love it. Adventure seeker. I love it.
I said I'm going to end up, I'd like to put my feet on different places of the world and travel the world. Yeah. I just came back in January from Marrakesh, and that was exciting. Okay. I get involved in the climbing the mountains, going to all the culture.
Oh, nice. It's important
to understand where we come from. I do a lot of traveling.
You were just in Peru, I think you said too, right?
I'm going to Peru. That's my next.
Okay.
Yes. Miss you. I went to Israel about a year ago, and it's a good thing I went when I went, because I know that trip would not be happening anytime soon for anybody. Mm-hmm. Right? Mm-hmm. And just, you know, having the experience of different cultures. I mentioned my sorority, we're very active in, we're a public service sorority, and things like voter registration, economic development, education, and then just sort of hanging out with them is a lot of fun. And then just kind of being out and about, enjoying my neighborhood. I sat on the board of BRIC for a while in the Brooklyn Arts Council. That gave me some exposure to getting like great tickets to stuff. I still utilize it. But I was at the Guggenheim on Sunday, and there's a really interesting exhibit called Going Dark, and it is art mediums, video and oils and sketches and photography. And it talks about the intentional and unintentional invisibility of our people as it relates to racism in the U.S. So
that's one to check out.
So that kind of, just being out and about.
Okay. Okay. So we'll put some links to those organizations and also the exhibit that's going on now. So Valerie, before we sign off, is there anything that any last words you'd like to share with our audience?
Yes. Well, first of all, thank you so much, Florence. I know we've each other for, for years. And
years.
We were able to have this conversation. And I look forward to, more ways to collaborate in this work. One of the things when you and I were talking about this, one of the things that I said, I in going back and forth to the continent, and I've been to the Caribbean many times, different Caribbean names. When I went to Israel, we were getting a talk from an Ethiopian Israeli, and he was talking about what was happening over there, and he was saying the difference between anti-Black and anti-racism. So myself and the one of the other people I was with, who are, descendants that were moved over here to America, we were like, well, I don't understand, what are you talking about, right? It's the same thing to us, right? We didn't get it. And he said, when you're from the continent, the being Black is not the first thing, right, that comes to your mind. You're Ghanaian or Kenyan or South African or from Cote d'Ivoire, whatever. He said, but if it becomes part of your daily life that's in your face all the time, then you see it in a different perspective. And I think it took that statement for me to really understand how a deep colonization has change the fabric of the one thing that connects us Africans together, which is Africa. And so I realized I have to be accepting of that colonization as I move forward and hope to work more within the diaspora, whether it's on the continent or in the Caribbean or in, other places of the world. So that understanding that we as an African people have been put in this place very specifically and intentionally through colonization was a eye-opening moment for me. Yeah.
Mm. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Thank you for that, because I think that really sets our mindset in a place of how do we move forward together.
Exactly.
Yeah. Thank you so much. Thank you. So, listeners, you can catch us Tuesdays with new episodes at localcitizenspod.com or wherever you get your podcast. Please like, share, subscribe, tell a friend. It's Her Stories March, so we have wonderful stories of women coming to you all throughout the month and always. If you like it, leave us a review. We're looking for 100 in 2024. So until next time, bye for now.